Hi, and welcome to Light the Way, the teaching ministry of Pastor Colin Munger of Shepherd of the Hills Calvary Chapel. At Light the Way, our desire is to help you grow closer to God through the study, understanding, and application of His Word. So stay tuned, because at the end of the program, we'll have information on how you can reach us. For now, let's open our Bibles and prepare our hearts to hear from God's Word.
If I could just invite us all to turn in our Bibles to the book of Esther, chapter 2. The book of Esther, chapter 2 this morning. We're in a series that we've called Good Grief, and it's all about having a positive outlook during difficult times. And one of the things that I have learned about a life in faith is that often it is not what happens, but how we react to what happens that makes all the difference. And so something that on its face might seem very negative, with the right outlook, the right perspective, a little bit of faith, we can see that there is good that comes even out of the grief. And so our series is Good Grief. And this morning the message is called The Grief of Conviction. And it's going to be a lot of reading this morning, but we're beginning in Esther chapter 2. Probably one of my favorite movies of all time is a Christmas movie by the name of It's a Wonderful Life. You probably have seen it. But it follows the story of a man by the name of George Bailey. And you'll remember from the movie, if you saw it, that George lives in this tiny little town of Bedford Falls, New York. Just this everyday small town USA kind of place. But George has all these ideas that when he grows up, he's going to see the world, and he's going to travel, and he's going to go places, and he's going to do all of these things. And then one by one, every single time he has an opportunity to go and do something, some catastrophe will happen. Whether the bank is about to go under, or there's the Great Depression that starts, or World War II begins, or whatever it is. But for whatever reason, there's always something that gets in the way of his plans. And so rather than going off and doing what he wanted, he feels the sense of conviction to stay at home and to help the people there. And so the movie is called It's a Wonderful Life, because through all of that, George discovers that he truly does have a wonderful life. Think about that, and then consider the story of Martin Luther. I know it sounds very different, but just follow me on this. Martin Luther was a German monk who lived during the 1500s. And in 1517, he made history by posting a document called the 95 Thesis. It was 95 reasons why he disagreed with the Catholic Church, and usually it had something to do with the act of selling forgiveness. Well, the church got a hold of it, and they couldn't endure that kind of attack, and so they brought Martin Luther to a trial. And they told him that he was either going to be convicted and maybe even killed because of this heresy in their mind, or they offered him, look, if you just recant of all of this stuff, if you say you were wrong and burn the papers, then we'll let you go and forget the whole thing. Well, it was there in front of that tribunal that Martin Luther famously said, "Here I stand, I can do no other." Now think about that. And then think about Moses from the book of Exodus at the burning bush, how God called Moses to go and speak to the Pharaoh about the Hebrew people. And he said, "Moses, I want you to go and tell the Pharaoh to let my people go." And Moses said, "But Lord, you know, I see what's going on and all, but I'm not the right guy because I'm not a good speaker, and they're not even going to believe me. And who am I that I should go? And I'm not the right pick. Lord, anybody else," he says. And eventually God says, "Don't worry, I'll be with your mouth. I'll tell you what to say, but it's you that I want to go." And through that experience, Moses develops this conviction and this sort of compassion for all of the Hebrew people, and he does go. Go and he speaks to Pharaoh. Now, every one of these examples is a person feeling the grief of conviction. Last week, we talked about what happens when the things we want to do don't come through for us. And we talked about the type of grief that comes with unrealized goals. Well, this week, I want to talk about the other side of that very same coin, and that is the grief that we feel, not when the thing we want to do doesn't happen, but when we're called to do the thing we'd rather not. You see, at some point, every one of us will feel that grief of conviction. Whether we feel called to stand up for something we believe in or to serve in a way we weren't expecting, or to go somewhere that we don't want to, or maybe to speak out on some issue, or to even do something that we're not prepared to do. And maybe we're anxious because of it. We're reluctant because of it. Because this thing, whatever it is, this is new and this is scary. Or because it isn't what we had in mind. And maybe there's a risk attached to it. And there's a lot of uncertainty. There's danger in it. And yet we just can't shake this feeling that God has called us to this very thing. And there's no peace until we give in. There's no peace until we say, okay, Lord, I will go. And when that happens, it's not unusual to feel a sense of grief over that conviction. Because we know what we should do, and yet we don't want to do it. The Apostle Paul said, I don't understand my own actions. I want to do what's right, he said, but I don't do it. Instead, I do the very thing that I hate. Paul dealt with that same thing, the grief of conviction. And so today, I want to talk about a woman in the Bible who had a very similar experience. She was called by God and sent by God to do something she didn't want to do. And yet, through this experience, she will learn to trust in God's timing and his planning. And because of her willingness to be obedient and to be used, many other people will be blessed. It kind of reminds me of the story of Joseph in the book of Genesis, how Joseph finally unveils his identity to his brothers, and they're standing there, and they're in terror, and he says, no, don't worry about it. Don't blame yourself. It wasn't you. It was God who put me here so that many people would be saved. And so that testimony will also be the testimony of a young woman by the name of Esther. And so we're in the book of Esther. And we're in chapter 2, and we're going to skip around a little bit, so I'll call it out as we go. But it begins in verse 1, where it says, after these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's servants who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. Go down to verse 7. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So it was, when the king's command and decree were heard, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan, the citadel, under the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace, in the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women. Go to verse 13. Thus prepared, each young woman went to the king, and she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the women's quarters to the king's palace. In the evening she went, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women, to the custody of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch, who kept the concubines. She would not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and called her by name. Now when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter, to go into the king, she requested nothing but what Haggai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. The Bible has 66 books. And of all of those books, I would contend that Esther is probably the most unusual. And that is because it has 10 chapters, which isn't unusual. It has 167 verses, which is not here or there. But nobody really knows who wrote it. Now, some conservative scholars will say it was Ezra the scribe, or maybe Nehemiah. Others will say, well, no, it was Mordecai. It was Esther's stepfather who would write this book. But the truth is, no one knows for sure. Not to mention that in all of the 167 verses of the book of Esther, did you know that God is never mentioned a single time? In fact, the book doesn't mention prayer. It doesn't talk about the law of Moses. Faith is never mentioned. Not a single New Testament author quotes from the book of Esther. And then there is the fact that it wasn't even among the Dead Sea Scrolls when all of those were found. Not to mention the whole book, the whole story reads a lot like a Disney princess fairy tale. You have an orphan Jewish girl who grows up to find favor in the eyes of the king to become queen of all of Persia. She discovers this wicked plot to take out all of the Jews, which we're going to read about here in a minute. So she goes to the king at great peril to her own safety. She saves her people and they all live happily ever after. And so we say that it's one of the most unusual books of the whole Bible because of that. It's actually so strange that Martin Luther was quoted one time as to saying he wished the thing had never even been written because he didn't know what to do with it. And I bring all of that up because it points to something very important for this morning, and that is to just recognize that even though we might not see it, even though it may be subtle, even though it's discreet and it doesn't rise to the surface all of the time, the fact and the truth of life is God is always at work. And sometimes he works behind the scenes, getting everything ready, orchestrating all the events, things that you might not even recognize because they're so small in and of themselves. And yet it is God who's putting everything into the right place so that when the time comes, it's ready. It was Paul who said in Romans 8 that God works all things together for the good. And I will tell you that he does that in our lives every single day, putting you in just the right place so that you're ready for that phone call, or so that when you bump into that person in the store, you have just the right thing to say, even if you don't realize it, or even giving you a burden for something long before the opportunity to act even presents itself. I was reading the other day about the Persian Gulf War in 1991, and most people are familiar with the event. It was when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, and the UN got together and said, you can't do that. And so they sent 1 million soldiers led by the United States, 700,000 U.S. servicemen in that million. And in a period of about 100 hours, delivered the most decisive military victory in human history. But what a lot of people don't know is about the buildup that happened before it. As early as August the year before, the U.S. started moving troops and ships and planes and trucks and building hospitals and cafeterias and airstrips and bases and commissaries and fences and all kinds of things, the infrastructure that was going to be needed, reorienting satellites so that they would be in the right place at the right time. And so one transport at a time, one airplane ride at a time, one boat at a time, people and equipment moved into position. So that when the time came ready, on January 16th, 1991, 500,000 soldiers invaded Iraq. In military, they call that hurry up and wait. And sometimes God calls us to hurry up and wait. He's moving, he's doing something, but it's not flashy. It's not impressive. It doesn't seem to be connected. It's not attracting all the attention. And at first glance, it's easy to overlook that God is even in it. And yet he's putting all the things into position, developing all the resources, building up the strength, a lot like a chess master, moving all of the pieces right before checkmate so that when the time comes, everything is ready. I like what it says in Proverbs 3. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding. In all our ways, acknowledge him. The big things, the small things, God is at work. And so as we see in the story of Esther, God is working in the background. He's behind the scenes. Although he is the star of the story, he's not very obvious in it. And so the things that he's doing are more subtle, but he is there nonetheless, putting all the things right where they need to be. And so Esther is being prepared. The second thing we notice is that Esther has a problem. So we go to chapter 3, verse 1. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. And all the king's servants who were with the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. Go to verse 5. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay homage, Haman was filled with wrath. Go to verse 8. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other peoples, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work, to bring it into the king's treasuries." So the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, "The money and the people are given to you to do with them as seems good to you." And so Esther's problem is a lot like many people's problem for a couple of reasons. One, it's a problem she didn't expect. In the book of Ecclesiastes, it tells us that the sons of man are snared in evil times when it falls suddenly upon them. And that's usually how things happen. They happen suddenly. It's out of nowhere. It's without warning. It's out of left field. Everything's going fine, and then one day the phone will ring. And on the other end of it is the doctor. And the doctor's saying, "Oh, I'm glad I caught you. We need to talk about those tests from last week." Or at the other end of the phone, it's a parent saying, "You need to come home because mom or dad, they just don't have much longer." Or it's the police saying, "We need you to come to the station. So-and-so's been in an accident. We need someone to identify the body." Or maybe you find out that the company you've been working for forever is going to shut down, and now the retirement is in question. And it doesn't even have to be a personal crisis. It could be something else. It could be a storm that the weatherman said was going to pass over, but it doesn't, and the home is lost. I was talking to someone just the other day who was telling me how one of his family members lost their home to a fire recently, and how he was away from the house, and the neighbor called him and said, "There's nothing you can do, but you need to know that your house is on fire, and it's going to be a total loss." He rushed to the scene. He watched the firemen do their job, but there was nothing they could do, and the whole thing burned to the ground in front of him. Or we think about how back in March of 2020, everything one day was going along just fine. We had plans that day and that week, and we think about all the events we were going to do, and how then the next day everything closed because of a pandemic, because of a microscopic bug that you can't even see. All of the world stopped. It was Peter who said, "Don't be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you as if something strange were happening." And it's interesting because the phrase he uses for "come upon" is the idea of suddenly, without warning. It's out of nowhere. And that's what's happening here with Esther. It's out of nowhere. It's suddenly. It's without warning. There is this problem that she doesn't expect. But also, it is a problem that she didn't cause. This isn't anything that Esther has done. She didn't bring this problem to light. This is because Haman is upset that Mordecai didn't show him the proper respect. This is all about Haman's ego and his pride and his hurt feelings. And so Esther didn't cause the problem, but she has to deal with it nonetheless. And that is often true for us as well. You're dealing with something that you didn't cause. It isn't your fault. There's nothing you did to bring this upon yourself, and yet there it is, and it's yours nonetheless. It makes me think of all the grandparents out there that are raising their grandchildren because of something that happened, and the parents are not able. Maybe they've died. Maybe they're unfit. Maybe they're in jail, or something has happened. But for some reason, these grandchildren now must be raised by their grandparents. And I think of the grandparents and how they did this already. They raised their kids. These are the golden years. This is supposed to be the time where the grandkids come over and everything is yes. You want to have a chocolate sundae 2 minutes before you leave for bed? Absolutely. You can do that at grandma's house. At grandma's house, you can stay up late and have no bedtime, but all of that has now been taken away, and now they have the task of raising and parenting their grandchildren. Or what about the young man who had planned to go to college? And he was going to play ball and graduate with a degree and start a family and have children and live in a nice little town. And then something happens like Pearl Harbor or Vietnam or 9/11. And the nation goes to that young man and says, I know you had all these plans, but we need you instead to go to war. Or the person who's struggling to buy food or buy gas or pay their electric bill because of some political thing that happened thousands of miles away. And likely you can think of something in your life. You didn't do it. It's not your fault. And yet for some reason you have to deal with it. It's become an issue for your life. And it could be the Lord has put a sense of conviction in your heart, or practically you have to deal with this, or legally you have to deal with this. And so Esther is presented with this problem. Haman has hurt feelings. And so Haman is going to kill all of the Jews. And not because of anything that Esther did. This isn't her problem. She lives in the palace. But it falls to her to act nonetheless. And so we see the problem. Next, we see the purpose. We go to chapter 4 for that. And it begins in verse 4 there. So Esther's maids and eunuchs came and told her. And the queen was deeply distressed. Then she sent garments to clothe Mordecai, who, by the way, is in mourning because of all of this, and take his sackcloth away from him because he would not accept them. Then Esther called Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs, whom he had appointed to attend her, and she gave him a command concerning Mordecai to learn what and why this was. All the king's servants and all the king's people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who... verse 11. All the king's servants and all the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court to the king who has not been called, he has but one law to put all to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter that he may live. Yet I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days, so they told Mordecai Esther's words. And Mordecai told them to answer Esther. Do not think in your heart you will escape the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise from the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to this kingdom for such a time as this? I like how some versions put it, whether you have been prepared for such a time as this. Even though it's not obvious at first, even though she didn't cause any of these problems, everything that has ever happened in Esther's life has been for one purpose, to put her in this place at this time for this reason. As it says in verse 14, come to the kingdom for such a time as this. You see, with God, there is no wasted effort. Nothing's random. There's no chance. There's no lottery. God's reasons are clear, and he has a purpose for everything. In Ecclesiastes, it says there is a purpose and a time for everything under heaven. And so everything from losing her parents to being adopted by Mordecai, to marrying the king and becoming the queen, to discovering this plot of Haman, to destroy all of the Jews, all of that has prepared Esther for what she's dealing with right now. This conflict that she has to go and tell the king, even though the danger exists, even though the law is that anybody who does that and the king is annoyed with must be put to death. Well, she's not been invited. She needs to tell him. Time is of the essence. But if she does, it could mean her very life. And so Mordecai says, you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. You know, the same is true often in our lives. You are not here by accident. Everything you've ever encountered, all of your experiences, all the jobs that you've had and lost, every relationship, every friendship, every hobby, every book that you've read, every neighbor that you've had, every path that you've walked, all the schools you've attended, every place you've lived and moved to and from, and all the stuff that never happened. All of it comes together to put you exactly where you are for a reason. I think about Moses and how he was given up as a baby because his mother was worried that the Egyptian soldiers would come and kill him as they were killing all the other children. And so she put him in this basket and sent him down the river. Ironically, and in God's providence and in a sense of ironic humor, God has the very daughter of the man who ordered the killings to actually find and then adopt Moses. And so he's raised by the people who killed or would have had him killed. But he then grows up as a prince of Egypt for 40 years, and he learns everything. He learns military strategy. He learns how to command people in the field. He learns how to deal with project management. He learns to read and do math, and he learns all of it. But he never forgets those Hebrew roots. And contrary to the movie, there was never this time where he discovers it and kind of goes nuts. He knew it all along. The word Moses means drawn out of the river. It's a Hebrew name. And so Moses knew who he was, and that side of him becomes stronger and stronger. And one day it takes over because he watches this Egyptian soldier murder one of his brethren. And the Hebrew side of him strikes down that soldier. Well, that ends his 40 years of privilege. It sends him into the wilderness for 40 more years where he's going to be a fugitive. He'll get married. He will tend his father-in-law's flock. And so for 40 years, he learned how to be a leader. For 40 more years, he learned how to be a servant. And by the time he was 80 years old, he was ready for what God had called him to do. Look, right now, you might be dealing with something that you would rather not. And it's not anything that you've done. It's not your fault. Can't be predicted. It's not even fair. But it's fallen to you. By the providence of God, it has fallen to you. Let me remind you that God did not make a mistake. It's not like he had one person in mind, but they were busy that day, and so he went to this other person and said, I'll just give it to them and they can figure it out. Every part of your life, everything about who you are and what has formed your thinking and the things that you've endured and the battles that you've fought and the victories and the losses and the illnesses, all of these things that you've seen in life, it all has worked together to create you into the person that you are, come to the kingdom for such a time as this. It kind of reminds me of when I was working in construction. We had a tool for everything. You want to take a window pane out of a window? We got a tool for that. And it wasn't even a hammer. I mean, that was one tool for it, but we actually had a way you could cut that thing out. You want to install insulation around a door frame, a special tool for that. You want to bend metal, special tool for that. Remove a broken nail, we had a tool for that. You want to look inside a wall, we have a tool for that. Any carpenter will tell you that having the right tool for the job can make all the difference. Well, just like the carpenter will call on a specific tool for a task, so too does God call on specific people for purposes. And so whether it's fighting a war or raising children or starting a business or writing a book or speaking out on some issue or confronting an injustice or caring for the sick or a life of service or, as we see with Esther, saving people from genocide at risk to your own well-being, you are not there by accident. It says, prepared for a time such as this. And so God prepares. Even though it's not obvious what's happening all the time, even though some of the things are so small they don't get noticed, that every event, every victory, every setback, it's all there to prepare the person. We see a problem. Now, Esther didn't cause it. But it's her problem nonetheless. And often that is how problems go. They come out of nowhere and you look up and there it is on your doorstep and you have to deal with it. And all the stuff that's happened in your life, all the things that have prepared you for this problem have done so for a purpose. So that you would be right where you are when it happens. God didn't make a mistake. And if he gave you this, it's because he knows it's something that you've been prepared to deal with. I love what it says. Paul says that God is faithful and will not let you be tested beyond what you're able. And so whether you feel confident about it or not, God does not put us in positions that we cannot handle. And so it goes with Esther. And so she goes to the king. And she does speak to the king. And in fact, before she goes to the king, she settles it in her heart and she says, if I perish, I perish, but I've got to do something about this. And so she goes and she speaks to him. She tells him everything. That happens in chapters 5 and 6. And then notice what happens in chapter 7. We see what has happened as a result of Esther's courage and obedience. We see what that has produced. In chapter 7, verse 5, it says, King Ahasuerus answered and said to Queen Esther, "Who is he and where is he who would dare presume to do such a thing?" And Esther said, "The adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman." So Haman was terrified before the king and queen. Now, Harbona, one of the eunuchs, said to the king, "Look, the gallows, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on the king's behalf, is standing at the house of Haman." Then the king said, "Hang him on it." Because of Esther, the entire Jewish population will be saved. And as it happens, no one else could have done the same thing. No one else could have gotten that close to the king. No one else also had a connection to the Jews. And it was because the king loved Esther that he was willing to listen to her, even though she interrupted a meeting that she shouldn't have interrupted. And so God put all of that together, and he put her in that place for that purpose, for that moment, and Esther is able to save her people. And you might feel like an Esther right now. You might be dealing with something, and you're wondering, "Lord, why me?" And you're tempted to think, it must be just some big mistake, that this is not at all what I wanted to do. This isn't my business. It's not my concern. I didn't see nothing. I don't know nothing. I didn't hear nothing. So just leave me alone. It isn't my fault. It's not my business. I'm better off just minding to my own. Or that it's not what you had planned for life. Isn't your passion. It's not something that you ever saw yourself doing. Or maybe it's risky, or it's dangerous, or it's thankless, or anything that tells us, "Lord, not me." And yet remember that God does not make mistakes, that if he put you in a certain place with certain conditions, the only reason is because he chose you. Because who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for a time such as this. Father, we read these words of Esther, and it's such a strong story. Lord, because of the things that are between the lines, the things that are in the text, because of the things that we know you're doing, even though it's not written. Because all of us, Lord, can look at our lives and we can wonder, why this, why that, why now? I just don't see how any of this is going to work together for the good in any way, shape, or form. This isn't what I think God has called me to do. This isn't what I have a passion for. And yet this is what's there. And Lord, I just can't help but make any sense of this. And we pray and it seems like there's silence, and we ask questions and they go unanswered. We read through the Bible and nothing jumps out at us. But then we take a 30,000-foot view of the book of Esther, and we see how you are moving all of these pieces together so that when the time came, that your servant was in the right place at the right time, prepared for a time such as this. So, Lord, for us, as we deal with that in our own lives, as we look at all the details and how they might be working together, I pray that even when it doesn't seem to add up, that we would be able to stand back and to say, "Well, God hasn't made a mistake. I'm here for a reason. And it could be that I have been prepared for this very thing." Father, would you remind us of this when we deal with the confusing things of life? Would you help us to remember this when we would be tempted to say, "Nope, that's not for me." Father, would you be with us? Would you bless these elements to our body as we move into communion? And be with us as we take them and remember, in Jesus' name, amen.